today's featured guest, Harry S. Dent Jr. Harry S. Dent Jr., editor of the free newsletter Survive and Prosper, head of HS Dent Forecasting, also author of several bestsellers. How's the weather today in Puerto Rico?
It's good as usual. A little cloudy, but it's sunny, and all I see is water here.
Friend of the show, Peter Schiff, also recently purchased a condo/townhouse in Puerto Rico.
If we're building a house on an island, Culebra, but we're leasing a condo in Condado, which is kind of like the hippest, you'd never know there was a recession sitting where I'm sitting.
Because we keep hearing all these horror stories about bailouts and things, but apparently not a big issue. Well, let's move to the domestic economy. You know, the labor market conditions index is a favorite of ours here, a leading economic indicator. When it drops below zero, and labor conditions tend to slacken a bit for a few months, as we've seen now since January of last year, we tend to have a recession fall. Not always, but sometimes. Have you any concerns about labor numbers?
I'm not as concerned there for the reason that it tends to be a lagging indicator, whereas stocks tend to be more leading, and also, you know, and at least GDP and retail sales and all are more coincident. So, I mean, I see signs. I mean, everything keeps slowing, you know, despite so much stimulus around the world and free money. I mean, basically, bonds everywhere are either yielding negative or zero when you adjust for inflation, and that's free money. With all this free money and quantitative easing, we're still growing. Like, now it looks like more like 1%. So we're certainly headed there. I think I am highly convinced that 2017 is going to be a bad year for the markets and the economy. It's just a question of how soon the markets kind of recognize this, because they certainly don't right now. The markets still feel like, well, you know, central banks got our back, and money's free, and life's okay, and the economy's not great, but it's not terrible. So stocks just go up because there's nowhere else for people to put their money.
There's another metric we like to follow, and that's temporary jobs. You know, the theme there, the trend, another forward indicator. And we're starting to see this sag. It's a bit of a newer metric. We don't have a lot of data, only going back about 25 years. But it has started to do this, to decline sharply before every major recession of the last 2.5 decades.
Yeah, I mean, that makes more sense. Used cars are also a good indicator in the past, a lot of people told me. But since, you know, temporary workers, that's more flexibility. So that's the first thing people are going to cut. So, I mean, that would make total sense that would be a sign. And again, most things we see are saying we're going to be in a recession next year if we're not already kind of almost there now.
U.S. housing starts remain extremely strong for several years. Every time we keep hearing about the horror stories that are supposed to unfold, the housing crash part two, U.S. housing starts just keep bumping higher and rebounding.
Yeah, they are. I mean, the millennials have put off buying for a long time, and now I think they're just finally saying, well, shoot, you know, we can't wait any longer. And they're still nowhere near what they were at the highs. So I mean, it's relative that they're bouncing. But I also see housing as more of a lagging indicator. Stocks were almost always ahead of the housing market. 2006 was an exception because of the subprime crisis and because the demographic trends turned down on housing before they did in the general economy, and that's expected. But in a normal business cycle like this, I don't expect housing to start to go down and have problems until after the economy's well into a recession. So I do think we are in bubble number two, and it's much more extreme in areas like South Beach and then San Francisco and Vancouver and Toronto and most of the coastal cities and around the world. And China's just bubble I've ever seen in real estate. So I think real estate is going to be a problem, but it's not going to be the first thing we see. I'd be more looking for stocks to start to weaken first, and then I'd start worrying about real estate.
I'd like to talk about the balance sheet at the Fed. Policymakers have been holding the balance sheet at around $4.5 trillion. The economy, as you say, treading water. Again, holding steady for 2 years. What happens if they surprise everyone and don't keep adding to the balance sheet?
I just think, you know, I think the economy is going to continue to weaken. And so the Fed may be talking about raising rates or taking down the balance sheet somewhere down the road. I don't think they're going to end up doing it because I think the economy is going to continue to weaken, and they're going to be turning around saying, oh, my gosh, we got to do QE4. I think that's not far away, or the helicopter money, trick, you know, just start sending people checks in the mail or something, or printing money and building, you know, infrastructure or something. It's pathetic to me and really irresponsible that, you know, 8 years into this, that they still feel like, I mean, the economy's still on life support. And hey, we're the only ones that are just keeping our balance sheet at the same. I mean, Japan's furiously increasing it, and so is Europe, and the only tendency is to increase that, especially after Brexit. So, I mean, we're still the best house in a bad neighborhood with our demographics not as poor as Japan or China now or Europe, and our monetary policies are not nearly as aggressive, especially as Japan. But it shows how weak the underlying economies are, that this much stimulus this long, and Japan's still, you know, averaging around zero, and Europe's averaging maybe 1%, and we were averaging 2%, and now we're looking like 1%. It shows that you know, fundamentally, we're in a weak stage in the economy, and that is largely due to demographics and unbelievably high debt levels.
Okay, but give us an idea of why, if it's demographic-based, or at least partially so, why a nation like China, which is relatively young compared to the West, would suffer on a forward basis?
Well, there's a big thing happening there that nobody's seen. The biggest way that emerging countries grow, demographics is a number two indicator for me when I'm looking at a China or an India or Malaysia or somebody like that. I'm looking at urbanization and how rapidly GDP per capita grows with every, you know, 1% or 10% of increased urbanization. That is the biggest lever. Urbanization tends to triple the income of a worker that's moving from a rice paddy to just becoming a taxi driver in Mumbai or something like that. So what happened in China, they've been pushing urbanization much stronger than any other country, building stuff for nobody to support jobs for all these unskilled people coming in. And for the first time in 2015, more people went back to rural areas than went to urban. The urbanization trend has come to a halt. In fact, it's gone negative, but they're still building condos and infrastructures and office buildings and malls and railways for nobody. And so their excuse in the past is, yeah, we know we got a 27% empty condos and we're building stuff to, you know, for nobody, but one day we're going to need them. Well, they're not going to need them if people have stopped moving to the cities. And then there's good reasons for that, Chris. The cost of living there is unbelievable. I mean, Shanghai prices are up 8 times over 2000. The traffic is horrible. The smog and pollution is horrible. And these people are not registered citizens, so they don't get whatever education and health care and minor welfare benefits. And a lot of them have to leave their kids back in the rural areas with their grandparents so they can actually go to school. So it's a mess. And these people have finally said, you know what? This is too hard. We're not getting paid enough with such high cost of living. We're just going to go back to the rice paddy. And a lot of them are starting little businesses, you know, starting a restaurant or something like that. But this urban thing is done, and nobody stood up and said, hey, how is China going to keep building stuff for nobody when there really is nobody, not even in the future? The urbanization, that's a big deal.
Let's shift the focus halfway around the world to the EU. Thoughts on the Brexit? Should we assume that further dominoes will drop, or will they just reorganize?
No, there's going to be further dominoes. This is not just Europe. This is Trump America. This is everything. When you go into a more difficult economy like we did in the early 30s, everybody gets protectionist, free trade goes out the window, tariffs go up or whatever, or currency wars like we're seeing with Japan pushing down their, trying to artificially push down their currency. I mean, everybody starts cheating, and everybody gets protectionist. And unions tend to break up, if anything. So, I mean, I would not be surprised, Chris, a movement for Trump America. He's going to take his 30-40% loyal people and kind of create some separate state or something. I don't know. I mean, but there's no question to me. Brexit is the first of many. Italy is the next Greece. There's no question about that in my mind. And Portugal's not far behind them. They're going to have debt defaults, and there's no way to bail out, especially Italy. So that's going to cut. Does Italy have to leave the euro and the union so they can devalue their currency to get out of their mess? Because otherwise, what are they going to do if they're not going to get bailouts like Greece did? And Greece has gotten, I think, three major bailouts and are still bankrupt. Italy's got 18% non-performing loans. So I see, and the markets rewarded the UK for leaving. You know, everybody thought the market's going to crash. They crashed for a couple of days. They turned around and went up. The markets basically said, hey, you did the right thing, and German stocks and French stocks and Eurozone stocks have been doing poorly, and the UK's been doing better.
Wouldn't you say that was first mover advantage for the UK?
Yeah, they're the first mover. There's going to be more. More countries are going to consider this. The EU and the Euro is not that popular in France or Italy either. And so, you know, all Italy's got to do is get in trouble, and then next thing you know, Italy thinks, well, maybe we got to leave, but then maybe France or Germany says, well, we can't stay in this union, and we got to keep bailing out all these countries. So I don't know. It doesn't have to be restructured. It's not going to be workable, and countries are going to get more protectionist. And the big trigger for Brexit, because all the polls said elsewhere until very close in, it was this whole migration thing. Nobody wants to lose control of their borders.
We spoke with Jim Rogers in a Singapore office. He said, regardless of your standpoint or your viewpoint on this, it's always the refugees, it's always the outsiders, it's always the immigrants, it's always those born outside the borders who catch the blame. Because when economic conditions deteriorate...
Yeah, I mean, I'm pro-immigration. I mean, immigrants may have lower incomes and lower education in the United States, unlike places like Australia. They work harder. They raise their incomes. Their kids learn English. It's a good thing. Immigration is the difference between us and Europe. We've got stronger immigration, and Australia and countries like that have much stronger demographics ahead than the United States because they have stronger immigration than we do. Immigration is a good thing. The problem with this is these are not people who are moving by choice to better their life. They're just escaping a dangerous and difficult situation. They don't, you know, that's not going to happen easily. They're not the same religion or cultural backgrounds. These are going to be much harder to incorporate into Europe, and Europe's not good at incorporating immigrants like we are and like Australia is and Singapore. Singapore is stellar at this. I mean, they forced everybody, all different ethnic groups, to live in the same neighborhoods so they wouldn't have all this ethnic division. And they don't, despite all the different people they have there. So immigration's a good thing, but I think this one is more of a sinking ship. It's too big a cost. These people are going to take too long to bring into the economy and be productive, and a lot of them may end up going back when things settle down 3, 4, 5 years from now. Anyway, go back to where they can, you know, be in their culture and their religion. So I just think this is a mess.
Well, money's flowing in from the EU and Japan seeking return where there is none. And inevitably, you know, the spigots there run dry and search elsewhere. And that might be the impetus. Might they not just, the Fed officials, ratchet up that balance sheet again, continue with QE operations to keep the whole edifice standing?
Well, I think they will. As soon as the economy weakens, and I am super convinced it's going to weaken in the next year. They, of course, they'll go for QE4. The question is, will they have lost the confidence of the public? Because when you go and print trillions and trillions of dollars, then you fall back into a deeper recession. It kind of tells people, oh, that doesn't really work. And people, you know, they're tolerating all this stimulus because it's working enough to keep us from collapsing. But in the back of their mind, people are not stupid. They know you don't get something for nothing, and this is total something for nothing. Now, two things to note here. One is I think it's more than stocks. This is we look at how the futures traders or sentiment. They got the smart money, the commercials who are the real hedgers, and then you got the hedge funds and traders who just follow the trends, and they've got very good definitions of this. And right now, I've never seen this before, the smart money is short everything. They are record short treasury bonds. They're short stocks, especially the NASDAQ. They're short commodities. They're short gold and silver. I mean, and even somewhat short the dollar and the yen. Now, those things don't usually go up and down together. They've gone up together say, in the last year, and now this sentiment says we could see almost everything go down, and the trigger could be that this Treasury bond trade reverses, not because we get some surprise in inflation or something, although that might happen. It's just simply because traders at high leverage have piled into this trade of buying futures and, you know, 20 to 30 times leverage, buying bonds ahead of governments who they know are going to keep buying their own bonds. So they're just buying ahead of them and making easy profits at high leverage. So it's almost like a low-risk, free-gift trade from the central banks. But no trade goes up forever. And when everybody's piled in and there's nobody left to buy it, and then bonds are now negative instead of just zero increasingly, that trade could reverse. I've been warning for a long time that in the early stages of the next crisis, before bonds go lower in yields than ever, even in the Great Depression, they're probably going to spike up. We could see a 3% 10-year Treasury, I think, in the next 6 and 12 months, and that is definitely not good for stock valuations and definitely not good for real estate.
Okay. Can you help investors to understand why it might be wise to add a modicum or two to their portfolios to balance the betas?
Well, I think the biggest advantage is for diversification. That, you know, people, yeah, you have 5 to 10% gold and silver. I've been bearish on it because I see deflation ahead instead of inflation. And gold, the gold market's finally, in early 2013, Japan tripled their stimulus. And, you know, and all this, you know, we're just up in QE, and inflation started falling instead of going up. People finally got that we're not going to get this hyperinflation, and that's why gold took a hit. But late last year, we were telling people, look, gold's taken a big fall from 1,800 to 1,050, a short period of time. It's due for what I call a bear market bounce, and my target was 1,400. Well, we just got the 1,373 or something, or 77, and we could still hit 1,400 or a little higher. So I've been bullish on gold near term, but I still think that gold follows the commodity cycle, just like it did in the 70s and 80s. It went up with commodities. It peaked in 1980 when commodity prices peaked, and then it crashed into the 80s along with commodities. Gold is a lot of things, but it is also a commodity, and it is a super incredibly good inflation hedge, and was the best investment in the 1970s. But I don't see it being a hedge against deflation, and I don't see it as much a crisis metal as some of the gold bugs do, because I'd look and say, what was the biggest crisis we had in the last several years? And it was the meltdown of Lehman Brothers and the financial system in late 2008, and gold went down.
But we are seeing some interesting things in the topicality. For instance, Bitcoin plunges on news that there are security risks that were unforeseen. And see, this is just one of those black swan-like events that very few people saw coming, other than insiders, that suddenly increases the appeal of safe haven assets. Another thing that comes to mind, we tend to see negative correlation reestablish itself when stocks and bonds and real estate start to slide. And we haven't really seen that too intensely yet. But were that to happen, don't you think that we could get a final blow-off run in the metals as money turns away from the paper asset classes?
Well, look, last time in 2008, gold went up for several months after stocks, but then it collapsed with them in the second half of 2008. So, yeah, that's a possibility, but I think gold's already making that kind of preemptive run. And again, right now, when I look at the trader sentiment, the most extreme is in gold and silver. Like the smart money is like 300,000 contracts net short. The hedge funds are 300,000 net long. That is a huge divergence. It's similar in treasury bonds, commodities, stocks and other things, but the most extreme is gold and then treasury bonds. So that's saying treasury bonds are going to go down, which means yields up at some point, and gold's going to go down at some point. Now, that could still be months away. So that's kind of hard to call, but I tell you, I don't like seeing that sort of setup. And then again, I've never seen these indicators. The smart money is short everything except the euro and the British pound right now. Short everything.
So you're looking at the commitment of traders reports and noticing the institutional versus hedge fund.
The commercials, they call them. These are people who are really hedging and have to know what they're doing, and they're doing it for real reasons for their business. And then you got the hedge funds that just jumping, the longer something goes up, the more they jump on and pile in. So when you're at a major turning point, the large speculators or the hedge funds are going to be super long, and the commercials are going to be super short. And that's what everything, especially gold and treasury bonds right now. And I tell you, nobody expects treasury bond yields to go up. Well, I would be worried about that. I'd be selling some of my treasury bonds right now. I'd probably rather have gold than treasury bonds right now. HarryDent.com, real simple. Go there. We're giving away our book, the updated version of The Demographic Cliff. All you pay is $4.95 shipping, which is the actual shipping cost, so we're not even making any money on that. And we're also, the newsletter now is called Economy and Markets, and it's a free daily newsletter, and you can get that at HarryDent.com as well. So that's a way to get to know us. We have paid newsletters that people can trade up to, but, you know, the best thing is just listen to us, fall in love with us or not.
Best of luck with that incredibly exciting adventure.
Yeah, it was a difficult move, but we love it here so far. Bye-bye, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their RIA project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.